Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now onto the episode. Hi, and welcome back to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, your host, Francesca. So firstly, I just wanted to apologise for my voice in case it sounds a bit nasally. I've just got over a horrible flu. So I've had about 5 or 6 days feeling really, really rotten. And I was going to skip recording this week just because of how I sound. But then I thought I'll just do it anyway, so as not to be behind with my work. So something I really want to talk about today is the circadian rhythm, which you may have heard of, or maybe you haven't heard of at all. So this is completely new to you, or maybe you have a small understanding of what it is, but hopefully you'll learn something new today, or it is that you've heard of it and you just have no idea what it is. So this is something I'm really passionate about. It's helping people to understand their circadian rhythms, for people to be keen to, once they understand what it is, to want to support it every day, because a lot of people aren't even aware that it's a thing or that it's something that impacts our day-to-day sense of well-being, our quality of life, because it really does. It impacts so many different things, from mood, energy, and then overall hormone, I can't say the word balance because perimenopause is hormone imbalance, but how it impacts all of our other hormones and other systems in the body. And also how the change in behavior of estrogen and progesterone in perimenopause impacts on our circadian rhythm. So we really do need to know about it for, you know, from both directions, so that we can start to support our body to, as it goes through perimenopause. You know, we can't change or support something if we don't even know about it. So I am really passionate about teaching people about it. It's something I work on with clients and practically at a foundational level, because it just impacts so many things. And it's one of my foundational pillars inside the Empowered Perimenopause subscription, and that I've talked about on this podcast as well, the 4 foundational pillars. One of those is sleep and understanding the circadian rhythm. So today, I just want to go into the circadian rhythm a little bit more than I have already. But there are some previous episodes that you can also listen to where I talk about sleep and circadian rhythm there. So what is the circadian rhythm? So your circadian rhythms are 24-hour cycles that are part of the body's internal clock. They run in the background and they carry out essential functions and processes in the body for our health all the time. One of the most important and well-known circadian rhythms is the sleep-wake cycle, which is the rhythms of cortisol and melatonin across a 24-hour period every day. This sleep-wake cycle, circadian rhythm, responds to, or is sort of governed by, light and dark cues. So light and dark cues in alignment with this rhythm will keep your circadian rhythm aligned, so that will be somebody with an aligned circadian rhythm, and vice versa, light and dark cues that are out of alignment with it will mean that person will have a unaligned circadian rhythm. So for example, if you get daylight exposure upon waking, once the sun's up, even if the sun isn't necessarily out behind the clouds, you're still getting that daylight exposure, and then darkness during the evening once the sun's gone down, and keeping it dark all evening before, until you get to bed. That is essentially the light and dark cues that your sleep-wake cycle, your circadian rhythm, is looking for. And it's all going into the brain. So it's specifically the hypothalamus in the brain that's looking for these signals and is responding to those light, dark cues and sleep-wake timings of the person, for example. And it's this that keeps it in rhythm or not in rhythm. So the brain is responding to these things, these cues, and then as a result of that, it's signaling the release of those 2 hormones, cortisol and melatonin, released at different times throughout the biorhythm. So for example, cortisol, that's your energy mobilizing hormone. It peaks in the morning in response to daylight, but it's in response to your brain, your hypothalamus in the brain, seeing daylight, not just you're lying in bed, curtains are shut, and it's daylight. And then melatonin rises, so the hypothalamus will sense, for example, darkness at night, and melatonin rises in response to the onset of that darkness to facilitate restorative sleep. So cortisol is the morning hormone, rises and peaks first thing in the morning. Melatonin is that darkness nighttime hormone in place of cortisol to help us to sleep. So they do the opposite thing. Now, a healthy person sees a peak in cortisol within 30 to 45 minutes after waking in the morning. And that's something called the cortisol awakening response, or we shorten that to CAR. That stands for the cortisol awakening response. And then gradually their cortisol levels taper down for the rest of the day until they're lowest at night in time for sleep, whilst melatonin at that point is now rising to facilitate a good night's sleep. We're getting lower cortisol because that's your wakefulness hormone, and we're getting this nice rise in melatonin instead. Now, the CAR, the cortisol awakening response, your daily rhythm pattern of cortisol and melatonin, they can all be measured in a salivary cortisol or adrenal stress index test. So this is just what these tests would be called in, they're basically functional health tests. So you wouldn't necessarily get these from your regular GP or conventional doctor. This would be classed as a functional medicine, functional health test. So a practitioner like myself, nutritional therapist, we are trained to use these tests, or a functional medicine doctor or other functional medicine practitioner would be trained to use these tests. So it's called salivary cortisol or an adrenal stress index test, which is a salivary cortisol test. In my practice, I use specifically the Dutch test, which is, it stands for dried urine test for complete hormones. And that's by a lab called Precision Analytical. And that also, not only does it look at estrogen, progesterone, and how we're metabolizing those hormones, but it's also telling me, it's giving me this salivary cortisol test as well. So that's what I tend to use in my practice. But anyway, circadian disruption, so that rhythm where I just described cortisol rising in the morning, but within 30 to 45 minutes of waking, and then tapering down throughout the day, and melatonin taking its place in the evening, any disruption to that rhythm is a huge factor in almost all areas of health and well-being, including hormone health and your experience of perimenopause and menopause. Now, the circadian rhythm is foundational to almost everything else. So this is why circadian entrainment, or essentially just aligning the circadian rhythm, is a big area of focus in my practice. I think circadian rhythm in general needs to be more at the foundation of any sort of functional integrative health practice, and ideally conventional medicine one day as well. So hopefully that is, there are some GPs today that are aware of the circadian rhythm, but it wouldn't be common practice. So hopefully one day it is something that conventional medicine is always talking about as well. So circadian rhythm disruption affects what's known as the HPA axis. So this is, H stands for hypothalamus, which is in the brain. P stands for pituitary, which is a gland in the brain. And the A stands for adrenals. So HP being the brain, A being your adrenal glands, axis means connection, communication, link. So it's brain to adrenal axis or communication. And this is basically the body's stress response system. So all stresses are sensed in the brain first. The brain decides, is this a threat or not? And then it signals down to the adrenal glands if it senses a threat to say, there's some threat here. You need to release adrenaline, cortisol to help this, to help us deal with this stress. So circadian rhythm misalignment, disruption basically is a stressor that the brain picks up on. And it means that over time, this HPA axis, this body's stress response system, is disrupted. So it has such a big impact on the nervous system. And then in turn, anything that has a big impact on the nervous system has a big impact on blood sugar regulation, insulin control, cardiovascular health, metabolic health, thyroid health, and so much more. And including our experience of various symptoms in perimenopause, our sleep, our energy, brain fog, memory, headaches, literally everything. So research shows that nearly half of all genes in the body that are expressed on any given day have some sort of circadian rhythm to them. So this basically means that nearly half of all of our genes that get expressed every day, they follow the circadian rhythm. So their activity fluctuates over a 24-hour cycle in at least one tissue and one system within the body. So imagine if the circadian rhythm is out of alignment, how does that then impact the expression of those genes and systems in the body? You know, for good or for bad, if it's in alignment, great. It's going to affect the expression of those genes and systems well. It's all in alignment versus if it's out of alignment. And an example of being out of alignment is simply somebody who's not seeing natural daylight within sort of 30 to 45 minutes of waking, and then they're accessing a lot of blue light at night and not really seeing the fact that it's dark because they've got lots of lights on, artificial lights on, watching a lot of screens up until bedtime. That is enough to put this circadian rhythm out of alignment. So how does that impact the expression of those genes and systems in the body? Possibly very negatively if they follow the circadian rhythm, which they've been shown to. So anything that follows or is expressed by the circadian rhythm, it basically tells you that all these genes should be firing at a given time during the day to make everything work efficiently. And, and obviously if our systems are working efficiently, that safeguards our health and vice versa if they don't. When that doesn't happen, there's inefficiency in the body. So that could be metabolic inefficiency throughout practically every system in the body, which increases risk of various, situations like heart disease, for example. It essentially impacts all areas of health. So in turn, inefficiency metabolically throughout practically every system in the body is going to affect other rhythms as well. So if that circadian rhythm is out of alignment, so will eventually other rhythms in the body, including the menstrual cycle, other hormonal cycles in the body. And that applies to everybody, men, obviously not the menstrual cycle for men, but other hormonal cycles and other rhythms in the body, that applies to everyone. But obviously I'm just talking about women here for perimenopause. So we can also call the circadian rhythm the cortisol rhythm because it's about the rhythm or pattern of cortisol across the day. So remember, cortisol is highest in the morning within 30 to 45 minutes of waking, and then it sort of tapers down until it's lowest in the middle of the night. So it starts to taper from sort of mid-morning, or let's kind of say lunchtime, it starts to taper down, and then it becomes at its lowest in the middle of the night once we've been asleep for many hours by then. So you see, cortisol signals to all of these clocks around the body and the tissues, because as we just, said, that there's essentially tissues in the body that have this circadian clock in them, in their genes. Cortisol signals to all of these clocks around the body in the tissues. So not in the brain, because the brain is the one signaling the cortisol. It basically tells cortisol signals to these tissues in the body what time it is, basically, if that makes sense. And if cortisol has got that time wrong, because your brain has essentially got that time wrong, because things are dysregulated, for example, your routine, what you're seeing in the morning, what you're seeing at night, you've changed time zones, the clocks have changed where you live, those tissues get the wrong information. Cortisol, when it's at its peak, is saying, okay, it's morning, so it's time to wake up. So within that first 30 to 45 minutes of waking, when it should be at its peak, that's saying to all of the cells in the body, all of the tissues, all of the systems, it's saying it's time to wake up, it's morning. And cortisol, as I said, is at its peak in the morning, triggered by daylight hitting the optic nerve in the brain. So for example, if that daylight isn't hitting the optic nerve, or the optic nerve is seeing tons of blue light at night, as I said, instead of, dim lighting, darkness, it can then start to think it's time to wake up at night and send those signals to the rest of the body as well. And we might just think this is only going to affect our ability to sleep if the rest of the body's awake when it should be looking to sleep. But no, it affects health. It results in a lot of disruption, energy, mood, sleep, weight, endocrine system, so essentially your hormone system, hormone output, including your ability to ovulate, make progesterone, metabolic health, including cardiovascular health, heart health, blood sugar regulation, insulin regulation, obesity, disease risk. So it doesn't just impact our ability to fall asleep, but it has a knock-on impact on things that affect our day-to-day life, quality of life, like energy, mood, sleep, but also risk of health issues as well later down the line. The way to start to recalibrate all of this dysregulation is by getting light hitting that hypothalamus in the brain in the morning, the hypothalamus then signaling the release of cortisol. And then all of the cells know what time it is because now the circadian rhythm is aligned. So it sounds like a complicated rhythm, but it's actually really easy to get it regulated. And one of the most important things, the most effective things to do, is have your brain, your optic nerve in your brain, see daylight first thing in the morning within 30 to 45 minutes of waking. And I think we can all make that happen. It might just be a tiny little adjustment or tweak in our morning. Like even if we don't have a garden or balcony to go out on first thing in the morning, once we've woken up, we can open curtains, open windows, stand by a window. So if your routine, for example, is just to wake up in the morning, at the moment you wake up, maybe you don't open the curtain straight away, maybe you switch on artificial light and you go straight into the bathroom, you have a shower under artificial light, go into the kitchen under artificial light, make a coffee, you know, whatever it might be, do your makeup, get ready, whatever that might be. That a simple tweak to that situation, to that routine, would be that you wake up, you put on a dressing gown or something. If you don't have a garden or an outdoor space, you open your window and you let the natural light in. Obviously, if you're waking up at a time when sun has risen, I'll talk about what to do if not in a moment. And you sit by your window for a good 3 to 5 minutes, ideally with your head out of it if possible, just so you're really exposing your eyes directly to that daylight. You know, you're not looking directly into the sun. You just want your eyes not to have a window in front of them between the optic nerve and daylight. But if you do have an outdoor space, even better, like I said, wrap up warm, put a dressing gown on or whatever, that get dressed for a minute and go straight outside and maybe have, you know, a cup of herbal tea out there, a cup of green tea or your morning water, and just sit out there for 5-10 minutes. The cloudier it is, the longer you'd want to stay out there, but the sunnier it is, the shorter you'd need. You'd only sort of need 3 to 5 minutes. And then get started with the rest of your morning routine. So that's a simple tweak that you could do. Now, if it's not yet daylight when you wake up, obviously now we're coming to the time when clocks are going to go forward soon. So here in the UK, it's going to be nice and bright in the morning. But for ages now, what's felt like years, it's been about 6 months, hasn't it? We've just woken up, obviously, in the dark. So for that, you can use a 10,000 lux light box. So you can simply buy these on Amazon for about £30. I've got two, one right by my bed. So as soon as I wake up in the morning, I just turn it on and it lights up the room and it sort of mimics that 10,000 lux that we would get from the sunlight. And then research shows that having that on around you for sort of 30 minutes upon waking on those darker mornings, if you can't get outside, has been shown to be sort of mimicking, really beneficial to mimic that daylight that you're not getting naturally. So I do that. And then I also have one in the living room. So as soon as I've got out of bed, because I'm not going to stay in bed for half an hour, I then just come straight into my living room kitchen area and I switch the other one on and I'm around that for a good half an hour in the morning. So that's just a really, really simple example of a way to sort of start regulating your circadian rhythm. I'll talk about a few more as we go through. So anytime you have somebody whose day cycle is completely shifting, let's say jet lag is a classic example of this. So, or even just daylight savings, I just mentioned, you know, I think it's next week, our clocks are going to go forward. And that's going to extend our normal clock a little longer than 24 hours. So going forward in spring is harder for us, harder on the body than going backwards is in October when we go back an hour. But yeah, jet lag. So people that do shift work where they're working nights and then on their days off, they're sleeping during the night again, trying to live a kind of normal routine with their family and then back on the night shifts again, like a day or two later. So all these kinds of things completely change that signal, which is trying to synchronize itself with metabolic signals, essentially, which is our health, metabolic health as a whole. So examples of the metabolic signals that your system is looking for are, yes, the daylight when you wake up, but also the time that you eat. So it's looking for, the brain is looking for this daylight first thing upon waking to signal, oh, it's morning, time to release cortisol, it's wakeful, come on, get up. But it's also looking at the time that you eat. So eating protein within an hour of waking is a great metabolic signal to give for a well-trained circadian rhythm and therefore a well-trained metabolic system. Now, this might go against all of the other things that you hear out there about fasting and how we should be waiting until lunchtime or waiting until 11 o'clock to eat. And that might be well and good for some people. It works very well for men. It works very well for younger people. And, you know, we can use that in certain sort of therapeutic situations if need be. But really and truly, your day-to-day, I suppose, attitude to eating would be that you are trying to get a good serving of protein, good sort of 30 grams of protein within an hour of waking. That is a really, really great, powerful metabolic signal to give to your body for a well-trained circadian rhythm and therefore good metabolic health. And by metabolic health, we're talking about blood sugar regulation, insulin regulation, your insulin sensitivity, which is really, really important. You know, your thyroid health, your heart health, your brain health, your weight management, literally so many things. Your hormone health, of course, that's like goes without saying. So all of this has a positive impact on hormones like sex hormones, you know, progesterone, estrogen, testosterone as well. And basically then eating during daylight hours. So getting that protein hit, protein and fat ideally. So for me, for example, I most mornings have a big protein smoothie. So it's got a good 30 to 40 grams of protein in there. And I get things like MCT oil in there, which is your medium chain triglycerides, which has been extracted from coconut. So that's my good fats in the morning, really great for the brain. I'll use flaxseed, pumpkin seed, sunflower seed, fresh coconut milk from a tin with no nasties. I use a cup of berries, just frozen berries to sweeten it. Sometimes I put a little bit of a sort of chunk of banana in there if I'm going to the gym. And then that's just my lovely dose of good fats and protein first thing in the morning. And then basically eating during the daylight hours. So getting natural daylight and being active in daylight hours as much as possible. Obviously, if you're sitting at the desk all day, you don't have a choice. You know, you can't just be outside all day. But just, you know, having a morning walk or a morning commute to work, if you do that anyway, that's great. You've ticked that box. And then, you know, in breaks, can you just have a little lap of the office, go outside for 5 minutes just to get some natural daylight, go back in. Imagine if you go outside for 5 minutes every so often throughout the day, how much extra daylight you're getting compared to not doing that. You know, you get an extra hour of daylight every day. So that's really good. And just trying to be active, because that is during the days, that is telling your circadian rhythm that this is it. This is how we train our circadian rhythm. We're awake and we're going. So then when you're not eating, it's dark. So essentially what your circadian rhythm is looking for is you're eating that protein in the morning, you're moving around, you're getting natural daylight, you're having another protein lunch, you're then having another meal, your third meal at the end of the day. And ideally, once it gets dark or very soon after it gets dark, you're now starting to wind your body down. And that includes the digestive system, which is why we want to switch that off as early as we can in the evening. And we don't want to be eating our dinner at sort of 9 o'clock. You know, ideally have it finished by 8 if possible. We really want to start getting that wound down as soon as possible. I try and have my dinner by 6:30, latest 7 o'clock most nights. But obviously, everyone's routine is completely different. So you can't, you know, there's no one size fits all. I can't just say everybody should finish their dinner by 6:30. Whilst that would be ideal, we all have different routines. I work from home, so it's very easy for me to do that. And if I didn't, and I was traveling home at 6:30 and not getting home till 8, then obviously I have to work with what I've got. So just, you know, as early as it's possible for you to manage. And that creates a really strong rhythm of this on and off, right? So this also means going to bed and getting up at the same time 7 days a week. So we don't want to be that person who's just kind of like, you know, on the weekends, their bedtime and wake up time is completely different to how it is 5 days a week. So for example, if we don't follow these ideal kind of patterns that your circadian rhythm would be looking for, these signals, it's kind of somewhat similar to if somebody goes on a flight across multiple time zones, and now all of a sudden you're trying to eat during the day, but your clock is still aligning with your original time zone and not yet synchronized with the light in the new time zone. That's what jet lag is, you know, that's the feelings that we get of jet lag. That's why we get it sort of sluggish, fatigued, achy, and just, you know, not feeling good. You feel like everything's off, and that's because everything is off. A lot of women in perimenopause will say they're starting to feel this jet lag sensation, and actually it's a clear signal that their circadian rhythm needs help to get into rhythm and stay there. And it's easier for our circadian rhythm to fall out of sync as we pass 40. Everything is more sensitive past 40, and your circadian rhythm is definitely one of those things. It was easier to sort of get away with different bedtimes, different wake times, not seeing daylight first thing in the morning, having lots of blue light at night in our 20s and even our earlier 30s or even later 30s. But as soon as we move into our 40s, it just, you know, it wasn't working anyway, but our body, our brain, HPA axis was, it was just more robust then. So we sort of got away with it in inverted commas. But as we pass 30, we don't get away with those things anymore. We now have to really start, you know, helping to align things that like we just did never needed to do before. So I do always, I hear so many people say things to me like, oh, but I've never been outside first thing in the morning. I've never had natural daylight. I've always used blue lights all night. You know, I've never eaten within an hour of waking. Yes, that might well be the case, but it doesn't mean that those things are going against you right now. It just means that you've got away with it this far. And now you've got to a point where you're not getting away with it anymore. And you do want to try out these new sort of habits and see if they make a difference. And, you know, 100% of the time they do make a difference. And people say, okay. So it's all very well saying, oh, I've never done that. I've never needed to do this. I've always done it this way and it's always worked. Things change when we pass 40, when our hormones change, when estrogen starts going erratic, when progesterone starts declining. Everything else shifts and we become far more susceptible, more sensitive to a lot of other things going off balance in the body. And circadian rhythm is definitely one of them. You know, everything, other systems, they're all impacted by this rhythm. We know that cardiometabolic health risks, so that's essentially heart health risks, metabolic health risks, increase in shift workers and aviation workers. You constantly cross time zones. And although you might not be doing shift work or working as cabin crew, for example, if your own circadian rhythms are out of alignment, these health risks will also be increased in you. You know, we see it in those shift workers and cabin crew, but it can also be the case for us if we're just not aligning our circadian rhythms as we should. And then that HPA axis, that body's stress response system, the brain to adrenal glands connection, is sensing this as a major stressor. And it's trying to resynchronize everything as quickly as possible. This is where you need to come in and take control of this rhythm for yourself and get it back in alignment. And that's what we would call that circadian entrainment. As I said, it's a big part of the work that I do with my clients. It's the first place I start, actually, because it's so foundational. So I'm just going to go through now some things that you'd be looking to do to trigger that cortisol response in the morning, that cortisol awakening response, the car, and then trigger the melatonin production at night and the tapering down of cortisol across the day after it's had its peak in the morning. So here are some things that you can do to train your circadian rhythm. So I've already mentioned the daylight exposure on your eyes within 20 to 30 minutes of waking. So I kind of said between 30 and 45 minutes of waking, but what you want is within 30 to 45 minutes of waking, you want to have that cortisol awakening response, which is this lovely peak in cortisol production within that time. So getting daylight exposure on your eyes within the first 20 to 30 minutes of waking will help to encourage that cortisol awakening response at the 30 to 45 minute mark of waking. So as I said, you know, whatever tweaks you need to do to your morning routine, a very simple tweak could just be that now you wake up in the morning, it's still dark or you can't get outside, switch on a 10,000 lux light box. As I said, I get mine from Amazon. They cost around £30 or just under. So if it's still dark in the morning or you literally just cannot get outside for whatever reason, you can switch that on and make sure you're around it for about 30 minutes. You don't stare straight at it, just like you don't stare straight at the sun. You just need to be in it. But the absolute ideal scenario is that you get yourself outside, whether it's you step out on a terrace, on a balcony, in the garden, you've just put a dressing gown on, you're just keeping yourself warm so that you can just get out there. 3 minutes on sunny days. If there's some cloud, you'd need about 10 minutes. If there's intense cloud cover, you would ideally want sort of 15 to 25 minutes outside. So I tend to use a mix of the 10,000 lux light box and, you know, because I haven't stepped outside in the UK to a sunny morning since, I don't know, a year ago, it feels like. So I just have the 10,000 lux light box as soon as I wake up. And then I also get up and go outside. And it's usually intense cloud cover. And I just stand there for about 10 minutes. I usually make my green tea and I bring it outside. And then dim the lighting at home from about 7 p.m. or even earlier if you can. But yeah, from about 7 p.m. onwards, have dim lighting. So avoid those ceiling lights from 7 o'clock. Just have nice lamps. Himalayan salt lamps are lovely. Just really nice, you know, dim lights. That's what you want. You know, you obviously want to be able to see what you're doing, but just want to try and avoid those really strong overhead lights. And then make it just get a little bit dimmer the closer to bedtime. So, you know, you're really just sending that signal to the optic nerve in the brain that it's getting darker, it's getting darker, it's getting darker. And so melatonin can start to be produced more and more in time for you to go to bed and then use that melatonin to sleep well. So using blue light blocking glasses throughout the evening is really ideal. So for any of your screen time, you know, TV watching, using your phone, using your tablet, using your computer. Ideally, we want to limit how much we use these things in the evening as much as possible. You know, we deserve that. We owe it to ourselves to have some space without these things. But in the evening is the best time to avoid those things, because any screens emit blue light. And essentially, blue light is the wakefulness light. That's the one that sends a signal to the optic nerve in the brain that it's time to wake up. So that's not the light that we want to be exposing ourselves to during the evening. So if you are going to, which of course we're human, we're going to, the use of blue light blocking glasses can be really, really helpful. And then, you know, you just want to make sure you're getting a good quality pair. I use a brand called Bond Charge. There's also another UK based company. I think they're UK based. I think they're just called Block Blue Light. That just might be their name. So have a look at them. They do some good quality blue light blocking glasses. You just want to be careful that you're not just getting a pair for like 20 quid, because the likelihood is they're not actually going to block much blue light. They're just, you know, following the trend. And then, so yeah, ideally we're wearing these glasses all night while we are using devices, including the TV. But then a good hour before we're looking to go to bed, at least 45 minutes before we're planning to go to bed, try to not use any screens at all. Even though you've got your blue light blocking glasses, we still want to avoid those screens, you know, just because that's really going to help, again, to send that signal to the brain that it's time to wind down, it's time to get some melatonin and get ready to go to sleep. And then in that time, in that hour before bed, you could be doing some deep breathing exercises, you could be doing some journaling just with a dim light on, you know, you could be writing down a few things that are on your mind. You could be jotting down a few things that you're grateful for in your day, a few things that you've got to get on with tomorrow, you know, just helping to get things out of your brain, like a brain dump onto paper. Really, really helpful to help you sleep better as well. If you're someone who lies there with ruminating thoughts, oh, I need to do this, I should have done that, oh no, what about this? Write it down. Use that hour before bed to have the dim lighting and just get everything out that needs to get out. Definitely practice some gratitude. Think about some things you're grateful for. That's been shown to be really powerful to help anyone who has those ruminating thoughts at night and anyone who just has trouble dropping off to sleep. And some deep breathing, as I said, a few minutes, 3 to 5 minutes, you could follow a guided meditation. You could simply just do the 4-6 breathing ratio, which I love. So you're breathing in to a count of four through your belly and your nose, a nice deep, you know, belly rise. And then you're breathing out through your nose, feeling your belly deflate. And you're doing 4 seconds in, 6 seconds out. And you can just simply repeat that for 3 to 5 minutes. It's really, really calming. It sends a lovely signal to your brain that it's time to wind down. Really helpful for sleep. And then hopefully you do manage to have a decent sleep, much better sleep than you were having before if you're following these tips. And then break your fast, as I said, within an hour of waking with a protein meal. So getting at least 30 grams within that hour of waking. And as I said earlier, it could be a power smoothie like I do, which I just find so, what's the word I'm looking for? I can't remember. So easy is what I was going to say. It's just the easiest thing for me to do. If I've got more time, then I will do, you know, I'll have a cooked breakfast. I will have a couple of eggs. I'll have some chicken. I usually have leftovers from dinner, whether it's chicken, lamb, beef, whatever it is, and I'll have a couple of eggs. I mix things up, just do, you know, whatever I fancy. I don't follow any particular rules about what a meal should look like. Sometimes it's leftover lamb curry and I put a poached egg on top. Sometimes it's some chicken sausages that I order in a monthly order that I get from a farm with a couple of poached eggs, some stir-fried vegetables. It just depends. Stir-fried mushrooms, tomatoes, spinach. It depends what it is. So anything that you can break your fast with in the morning that will give you 30 grams of protein. So just, you know, whatever works for you to get that. And then delay caffeine. There's some research to show that delaying your caffeine intake for the first 90 minutes of waking. So if you're someone that has an espresso, for example, as soon as you wake up, or some kind of other coffee, then research is suggesting if you wait an hour and a half after you've woken up, that can support your natural cortisol awakening response. So that rise in cortisol that should happen within that 30 to 45 minutes of waking, it can support that. Caffeine increases cortisol, but we want this to happen naturally, don't we? We want that CAR, that cortisol awakening response, to be triggered by our body, by our brain, naturally every day. We ideally don't want a stimulant to come along and do that. So waiting until that CAR has actually happened before putting any caffeine in can be helpful. If you currently have caffeine as soon as you wake up, just you could try it out for a week just to see if it makes any difference to your sleep, to your energy throughout the day, to fatigue. If it does, great, you're onto a winner. If it doesn't make any difference at all, then just go back to what you were doing if it worked. It can also be helpful to avoid having caffeine after 11 a.m. because you've probably heard this before, but caffeine has what's called a half-life. So it means it can stay in your system for up to 12 hours after drinking it. So if you have your last cup at 11 a.m., you know, 12 hours later, some of it can still be in your system. That's 11 o'clock at night. I think that's late enough. And that can then impact the lowering of cortisol at night that should be happening so that melatonin can increase. So that could be leading to less melatonin being made. And you won't know that unless you try. You need to test things out. So people say, but I've always had coffee up until 1 o'clock in the day and it doesn't affect my sleep. You don't know that unless you test it. You don't know if you could sleep even better by bringing that earlier, because you might not be making as much melatonin as you could make. You don't know that until you try. So I always encourage people not to be, very set in their ways. I've always done this. It's always worked. Let's just try something else and see if it makes a difference. If it doesn't make a difference, fine. Go back to what you were doing. If it does make a difference, excellent. Isn't that so great that you've made this really simple tweak that's allowed you to actually sleep better? It's like when people say, my energy's fine, but they actually just don't know what it's like to have more energy. So they think that their energy is fine, but actually if they were to do X, Y, Z little tweaks, they could have more energy. And then they'd say, oh, I didn't realize, you know, my energy wasn't fine. And then another thing is finishing dinner minimum 2 hours before your usual bedtime. So I've obviously said earlier about that. If you can, you know, whatever works for you. I like to finish my dinner by, as I said, 6:30, 7:00. I do tend to go to bed about 9:30, 9:00. So for me, it is important that I have finished my dinner by sort of 7-ish, because I am going to bed quite early. And that's just something I've done for about 4 or 5 years now. It's just the time that my body is ready for sleep. I'm not saying that people should be going to sleep at 9:30, 9:00, not at all. So if you're somebody who goes to bed at 11, or, you know, you tend to fall asleep around 11 o'clock, or that's what you want to fall asleep at, then yeah, you really want to make sure that your dinner is completely finished by no later than 9:00. But ideally earlier, just because the digestive system, on the circadian clock, the digestive system does start to slow down essentially not long after dark. So the earlier the better in the evening in terms of how well your digestive system will be at breaking down your food for you. It's going to be much better earlier in the evening than it is later. And essentially food timing is one of the biggest factors in regulating cortisol. So if we can eat our meals within daylight hours, like I said, protein dose, your breakfast within an hour of waking, and then finishing that last meal as early as possible after dark. And as I said, as early as possible works is going to be different for every person, but whatever you can do is ideal. And that, you know, it impacts our sleep, it impacts energy, it impacts weight regulation, body fat. And, you know, if it's going to impact the circadian rhythm, that's basically impacting every area of health. And just one more thing on your evening meal, a lot of women skip carbs in their evening meal. It was something that was touted years ago as being good for weight loss. You know, don't eat carbs at dinner, eat your carbs in the morning because you can work them off. Don't eat carbs at night because you're not working them off. It's not how it works. In fact, going to, you know, having your last meal of the day being low carbohydrate is just going to lead to blood sugar lows in the night that will essentially wake you up, because a blood sugar drop, a low in blood sugar is a stress. It's a stressor on the body. The HPA axis, the stress response system, picks up on this as a threat, and it increases your cortisol in order to try and get your blood sugar back up into the normal range. And that is going to wake you up and then keep you awake. So lots of women will say, I wake up around 1 or 2 in the morning and I can't get back to sleep. As soon as we talk through their dinner, and finding out they're having just like chicken or some other meat or fish with veg, I'm like, where's your carbs? Oh, I was told not to have carbs at night. So they're just having vegetables. They're having no starchy carbohydrate. And so once they add that portion of starchy carbs into their meal, so you're just looking at a sort of closed fist size of brown rice, or could be quinoa, it could be baby new potatoes, it could be sweet potato, it could be like a lentil pasta, chickpea pasta, some other kind of root vegetable, it could be beans and pulses. In that case, you would have like a two close fist size serving. Once they put that in, they say, I don't wake up anymore, I'm sleeping through the night. So it's really important that we're having a decent sized portion of slow release complex carbohydrates with our dinner to help keep our blood sugar levels stabilized throughout the night. It's also helpful to have something like, you know, making sure that with dinner that you do have some good fats. I mean, we should have good fats with every meal. That's what a balanced meal is. It's protein, good fats, plenty of vegetables, and a complex carbohydrate serving. But again, we don't want to just have this like really lean meal where we're not having any fats, we're not having any carbs. So making sure we're having that good dose of protein, we're having lovely fiber from colorful vegetables, we're having a portion of good fats, whether that's just a tablespoon of olive oil sprinkled over your food, whether it's nut butter in some capacity, whether it's coconut oil, real butter, avocado, olives, and then your portion of starchy carbohydrates as well. Now, these things would apply if you've changed time zones as well. So obviously, we're just talking about your day-to-day circadian rhythm. But for example, if you've changed time zones, and I say this because I came back from Thailand at the end of January and obviously crossed 7 time zones, and it took me so long to like just get back into rhythm. And they do say it takes a day per time zone to come back to normal, and I crossed 7 time zones, so it took me a week, which is about right. But just to say, you know, if you change time zones, you just want to stay active in their morning and see sunlight at the new destination that you've arrived at. Try to get to sleep during their darkness, even if you're running on your previous time zone where it wouldn't be bedtime and you're not feeling tired. Just really try to keep to this rhythm in that new time zone. Light this in the morning, darkness at night, protein first thing in the morning, and so on, and not eating late at night. Even if it's, you know, you're still feeling like you're in your previous time zone, you really want to get into their time zone like straight away. And also consider that some people mess up their rhythm on a weekly basis. So I know I said it earlier, I did this in my 20s and 30s, basically every week. So I was working office hours during the week, and then at the weekends, so I was like going to bed around 11, half 11, I was waking up at 7, 7:30 in the morning, 5 days a week. And then come Friday night, for Friday and Saturday, I was staying up till 1 or 2 or even 3 a.m. and just sleeping in the next day till like 10 o'clock, sometimes 11 o'clock, depending on the time I went to bed. And then Monday comes and I'd go back to the office hours routine and just feel rubbish until Tuesday or Wednesday, week in, week out. So here, we're basically forcing our HPA axis to cope with this disruption on a weekly basis. And that drains the reserve capacity of our stress response system eventually. And as I said, we get away with it. We do get away with it to an extent. We get away with it in our 20s. We get away with it in our earlier 30s, but as we move into our 40s, our hormonal system just is not robust anymore. And it's a time in our lives where we need to start taking control and doing things differently, doing things better. I talk a lot about the impact of stress on perimenopause symptoms, you know, the likelihood of symptoms, their frequency, their intensity, things like brain fog, focus, memory issues, headaches, hot flushes, night sweats, mood issues, anxiety, all the PMS, the new PMS that we never had before, the breast pain, the heavy painful periods, the histamine reactions we never had before, and so on. And if your circadian rhythms are not properly aligned and happy, a lot of these symptoms are worse because, one, your stress system is under a lot of pressure because it is a stressor, and two, other systems in the body are out of whack, including your hormones. So, as I said, they've already gone awry in perimenopause anyway, and therefore, you know, adding this additional pressure by not having this aligned circadian rhythm is just adding fuel to that fire and making symptoms more likely, more intense, more frequent. And so that is the beauty of doing some simple things like the list I just gave you to help regulate your circadian rhythm. It can have such a positive knock-on impact to so many different symptoms. And I hear it all the time. I get messages from clients literally a week after we've met, you know, we've had our first consultation, and they're saying, you know, and I haven't even sent them maybe within a few days of our consultation, and maybe they're still waiting for like the full write-up report from me. They're still waiting for their supplement plan. They're still waiting for, you know, the actual official plan. And they're like, I've already just done a few things that we spoke about on our session, and already my brain fog is gone, or my energy is 1,000 times better. I'm sleeping better. And again, the knock-on impact that has on other symptoms and so on. And it just ends up being, you know, eventually so many different positive knock-on effects mean that you're sitting there thinking, I've just actually like 20 different symptoms have sort of disappeared over the last few weeks. And that is possible. That can happen. So circadian rhythm is definitely one of those foundational pieces for that. So I really hope this episode has been informative, inspiring in some way, and helpful for you. And as ever, if you've got any questions, drop me an email. My email address will be in the show notes, but it's just francesca@francescaliparotti.com. You can also find me on Instagram, perimenopausenutritionist_FL. You can find me there and drop me a DM as well there. So any questions, any feedback, suggestions for things that you'd like me to talk about on future episodes, I am so open to hearing from you. So please do contact me there. And if you are enjoying my episodes, I would really appreciate it if you left a 5-star review or rating on Spotify or Apple, wherever you listen to podcasts, because it really helps me get the podcast seen by other people and allowing it to grow over time. All right, I will see you in the next episode. Bye-bye.
If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy. Or you'll also find the link in the show notes.